supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Right now in Center City, it is 79. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will discuss horseradish, how to get the biggest, tastiest roots, how to process it safely, and what to do when horseradish gets out of hand. We'll also talk to Andrea Wolf, who's been on the show before, about her new book about the founding fathers and their gardening habits. It's a lot to get done today, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's good hearing your voice. The reason I'm calling, sir, is to see if we can find a solution to the infamous fire ants. We're going down to Texas at the end of August, and we want to be down there to help out with my son, who has a place down there, as to how to overcome and control fire ants without damaging the earth or damaging the water supplies.
Gotcha. Now, where are you, Bob?
We're in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania.
And did you say which part of Texas?
Over around Katy, Texas, Houston area.
Okay. How long has he lived out there, Bob?
He's been down there almost 10 years now.
Okay, so he has a lot of experience. He's been stung by fire ants.
Yes, sir. They were at a picnic they were at, and this her daughter got bit by these
Man. You know, that is the problem is, you know, here in the north, we think of ants as forming a line and invading a picnic. But if a child gets injured by fire ants at a picnic, it probably means she stumbled into one of the giant mounds.
Yes, I imagine so.
Oh, that can be deadly. Fire ants are an imported pest. They come from outside the country, and their sting, unlike that of a regular ant, their sting is as venomous as that of a honeybee or even a yellow jacket. And,
wow.
And like yellow jackets, they swarm when one ant starts stinging something, a person, a piece of livestock, a pet. The other ants go towards it. It actually can be fatal, and they are a serious pest down south. But it's funny you mention that he's in Texas because these pests are all over the south. You hear... if you hear a sound right now, it's all our southern listeners leaning closer to the radio because they're really interested in what I have to say right now.
Oh, thank you.
In the old days, the treatment for a fire ant mound was boiling water applied at a precise time of day. The reason this worked well and still works well to this day is the ants are highly social, and they have a very complex system, and of course they're in a very hot area. So when the weather heats up in the hottest part of the day, they will actually move the queen all the way lower in the ground, as far down as she can go, to escape the heat. But the corollary is also true. First thing in the morning, especially after a cool evening, they will move the queen right up to the top of the mound. And of course, as with any ant colony or termite colony, you wipe out the queen and you've taken care of that problem. So years ago, they came up with a two-stage chemical solution called the Texas Two-Step, because I believe it was developed at Texas A&M. Maybe five, as many as 10 years back, they came up with the organic Texas two-step.
Good.
Which still relies on the timing. But if you go to a search engine and you type in organic fire ant control or organic Texas two-step, you'll be taken to a description of two organic pest controls, which are so popular and so effective, they are often sold banded together. The first part of the two-step is D-limaline, which many people know as the product Orange Guard. and it is just a distilled essence of orange peels, but it's a very powerful insecticide. The other half of the two-step is this new generation organic pesticide that I talk about quite frequently called spinosad. And like a lot of organic controls, it is a naturally occurring compound found in soils. But it is tremendously deadly to insect pests while not affecting non-insects. The only thing you really have to be careful about with spinosads is keeping it away from honeybees. And I don't think you could pay a honeybee to go anywhere near a fire ant mound.
Okay.
So your son can begin treating the mounds as soon as he can get these two products. They can be mail ordered to him together separately. A big independent garden center down south will stock both of them. You know, with the timing, Bob, he could be rid of the ants, the mounds that are anywhere near the house or where you're going to be working by the time you get there.
Oh, thank you, sir.
But no, thank you, because it's something, it's such a localized topic down south that fire ants are something we don't touch on nearly often enough, and they are as deadly as stumbling into a yellow jacket nest. So thank you. I always look forward to the opportunity to tell people that there is an organic way to get these mounds under control.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Bob. Good luck, sir.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ryan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing today?
I am doing very well today, Ryan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific.
And where are you terrific?
I'm in Tyndale, Pennsylvania, about an hour north of Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. And what can we do for Ryan in lower PA?
Well, I'm looking to grow hops. My wife and I brew beer whenever we get the chance, and we love the smell of hops, and we're looking to grow some for the smell and also for the for brewing in our beer.
Right.
So I was wondering, what exactly should I do? I know I'm past the growing season this year. What should I do to prepare for next year?
What kind of outdoor space do you have that you can accommodate a very lush vine that will get very large and need a lot of support and loves airflow and sun?
Well, I've got a quarter acre in a suburb area. I've got big white walls, and I've got a good bit of land I can grow if I need to.
Okay. No, you don't need white walls or anything.
Okay.
We discussed growing hops on the show extensively a few years back. Are you familiar with the Wireback Brewing Company? I think they're just out maybe in Easton, Bethlehem, that part of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know. Wireback, I know it. Yeah.
Yeah. They, as you may know, there was a hop crisis in Europe, what, like 4 or 5 years back? One of the guy whose name is quite like Wireback, I think it's Wirebacher, called me up and said that he wanted to do this, and was it possible? And just by sheer coincidence, when I worked at Rodale in the Lehigh Valley, a woman named Sharon Felton, who worked with me, had hops trailing from the ground all the way up to their second floor deck. And they were not utilizing the flowers. They just liked it. And as you may know, the original medicinal use for hops was as a sleep aid.
I did not know that.
And when the flowers open and they scent the air, you know, I don't think there was Prozac back then when I knew these people, but she said, you know, you would get really chilled out on a nice evening when these giant hop flowers were all open. So
I did not know that.
So what you'll do is you'll matter of fact, I would urge you to go to Wirebach's website. I know that they had blogs on there a couple of years back about their experiment, and their hop fields should be now in their fourth or fifth year and really kicking butt. These are perennials. I believe they kind of die back to the ground every winter here, but they come back. They are very rapid growing. They need support. They will get very big. They need to be trained up trellises.
Okay.
But they put on a lot of biomass in 1 year, and really what they need is a couple of years to get established, and a lot of open space. They need a lot of sun, and they need a lot of airflow. The only problem I'm familiar with hop plants is they can be very disease-prone when crowded or when they get wet. It's really a good idea for them to get morning sun and the plants not to be touching each other so that after a heavy rain or something, the vines can dry off very quickly.
Okay.
But other than that, it is my understanding that by the time they're 2 or 3 years old, they're essentially growing themselves.
Oh, that's nice to know.
What you mostly need is a good supply of high-quality plants. You'll have some choices in the types of plants that you'll want to grow. You'll research this. The guys at Weyerbach have a lot of information, I believe, on their website. They'll be happy to hold your hand. And I can tell you right now that more and more home brewers are doing this great experiment. And I haven't had anybody get back to me with significant problems.
That's great to know. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, good luck, and you owe me a beer like 3 years from now.
Will do. I'll give you a call.
All right, you take care, man.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all of our gardening friends in and around the area of Erie, PA, that I will travel to the very top of our fine commonwealth to appear at Goodell Gardens in Edinburgh this summer. I'll do a meet and greet on Saturday evening, July 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m., and then deliver one of Goodell's famed tea time lectures on Sunday, July 24th from 3 to 5. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the Gardens of the Founding Fathers, more of your fabulous phone calls, how to grow horseradish, and lots, lots more. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Moss Acres supports You Bet Your Garden. Moss is a low-maintenance solution for shady spots where grass doesn't like to grow. Moss Acres offers information and a variety of mosses online at mossacres.com.
It's 11:19. This is WHYY.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents Farm Work by Jamie, a new exhibition of paintings by artist Jamie Wyeth, featuring the artist's depictions of farm animals, equipment, buildings, and landscape painted throughout his career. Wyeth's interpretations of farm work and life combine his artistry, wit, and sense of wonder. No tickets required on Sunday mornings. The Brandywine River Museum is located on Route 1 in Chad's Ford. Details at BrandywineMuseum.org.
WHYY forecast, mostly sunny today, the high about 82. There is the chance for a stray thunderstorm later on. Tonight, some clouds, the low 64, and sunshine in store for Sunday. Sunday's high, 84.
This is Marty Moss Cohen. As WHYY comes to the end of its fiscal year, we thank you for your support during challenging financial times. Now visit WHYY.org and make a pledge to help get the next fiscal year off to a strong start. Thanks.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how to grow and control and use horseradish. And, of course, lots more of your fabulous phone calls in just a few minutes. But right now, it's time to welcome back a guest who we've enjoyed very much in the past. And she has a brand new book out on the Gardens of the Founding Fathers. The book is Founding Gardeners, the Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation. And the author is Andrea Wolf. That's W-U-L-F. Andrea, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you here. I will say that it seems like, I'm going to guess that in researching your book on John Bartram, who brought American gardening back to England, you learned a lot about gardening in America at the same time.
Yes, because I think it was, so when I researched the last book, The Brother Gardeners, through my research on John Bartram, I really stumbled over the Founding Fathers. So first of all, John Bartram, as many as of your listeners will know, lived in Philadelphia, and he was a very good friend of Benjamin Franklin. So it was through his friendship with Franklin that he was put in contact with English gardeners and stuff like that. And as I did my research and read through diaries and manuscripts, I came across an account, for example, of the a visit of the delegates of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 to his garden. There was an invoice to George Washington, who had ordered hundreds of trees and shrubs for his garden in Mount Vernon. James Madison visited, John Adams visited, and Jefferson even found time to visit while he was writing the Declaration of Independence. So the Founding Fathers kind of popped up everywhere, really.
Well, I'll jump ahead here and say that the Founding Fathers were more than a little distracted by gardening. I mean, there's a story in here about Washington being summoned to battle, and he's telling people, no, he has to write this lengthy, 2-hour letter to his caretaker at Mount Vernon?
Yeah, I think this is just one of my favorite scenes, actually, in this book, is that in the summer of 1776, when New York is facing the first and largest battle of the War of Independence, Washington is kind of sending away his generals, kind of brushing away his military maps, and he's sitting down writing a letter to his estate manager in Mount Vernon, and he writes to him a letter asking him to design a new garden. And what is even more remarkable than the timing is that he's asking him only to plant native species. So it's almost as, you know, it's almost like his horticultural declaration of independence, you could say, because he wants mountain laurels, he wants crabapple, he wants magnolias. It's almost as if he wants to create an all-American garden where no English tree is allowed to claw its roots in its soil.
But, I mean, he's supposed to be getting ready for one of the fights of his life.
Well, I think what we really don't know is that they regarded themselves foremost as farmers and as gardeners. And if you look at Washington, for example, during his presidency, he is... Most people just expected him to serve for his entire life. And he says, after the second term, he says, you know, I want to retire, because he wants to go back to Mount Vernon. He wants to get back to his plantation. He wants to go back to his garden. They're all very much hands-on gardeners also. They really need to, you know, feel the dirt in their fingers.
One thing that surprised me is, you have to realize, growing up in Philadelphia, we're overwhelmed with Benjamin Franklin. It's like it would be easier and simpler and a much shorter piece of paper to list the things that Benjamin Franklin did not create or invent.
Yes.
And before you begin the book, in the prologue, you talk about how much he loved plants as well. And you just mentioned that he had a friendship with John Bartram.
Benjamin Franklin is, unsurprisingly, I suppose, deeply involved in this. He's actually, I would say, the first of all the revolutionaries to put seeds at the heart of the struggle of the country, because what he's doing is, when he's in the run-up to the Declaration of Independence, his changing attitude to seeds and good agricultural crops really mirrors his changing attitude to Britain. And it's almost as more as he believes that declaring independence is inevitable, the more frantically he begins to, you know, send seeds which might be useful for America over from London to America, because he says that America has to be self-sufficient in order to be independent. So the need for agricultural crops and vegetables becomes increasingly more important.
And it's laser sharp, right? It's all about edibles. It's all about survival. It's all about this becoming a self-sufficient place, because of the people saw the verdant land, like Penn did, you know, Pennsylvania, the Sylvan Fields. I can't believe, however, it's the first thing I've heard that he got wrong. He got tofu wrong?
Yes. So he basically he was interested in everything useful, basically, everything that had a useful application. So he got the recipe of tofu and he muddled up the chickpeas and the soya beans. So, but that is the only thing. And
in other words, he tried to make tofu from chickpeas.
Exactly.
And it went badly.
Exactly.
It's nice to know that he got something kind of wrong.
Oh, well, no one believed that they would just kind of try something once and then it would work.
And you stress over and over again that the Founding Fathers are united in this theme that agriculture, and you even use the term small-scale farming, will be the building blocks that will make this nation strong.
Basically, they believe that agriculture is the foundation of the young republic. They believe that they are almost like the guardian of liberty. They're virtuous, they're industrious. They have a real connection to the land, so they're invested in the land. So that's important for them. They think that traders, speculators, they don't really have a, you know, they don't really believe or they don't have this connection to the land. So agriculture for all of them becomes incredibly important. And it's interesting to see, for example, how Jefferson and Madison in their fight against Alexander Hamilton, Hamilton very much believes that America should have close trading connections to Britain. He believes that America should be a manufacturing country.
Which it eventually became.
Becomes. So when Jefferson and Madison see what Hamilton is doing, they go on a botanical trip to the New England states in the summer of 1791. This is just after Hamilton has founded the Federal Bank. And they use plants almost like a botanical weapon, because what they do there is they try to find out as much as possible about sugar maples, because they believe that if every farmer in the United States would have a sugar maple orchard, then America would not have to buy molasses from the British West Indies, which would mean that you don't have to trade with the old enemy. So everything becomes incredibly political. For me, the greatest surprise in writing this book, and I think the most exciting thing, was to find that Madison is not just the father of the Constitution, but that he's really the forgotten father of American environmentalism. He gave a speech in 1818, which was widely published in Europe and in America. And it is an extraordinary speech, because what he says there is that Americans have to protect their environment in order to survive as a country. And he says that man has to return to nature what man takes from nature, which is a remarkable thing to say at that time.
And you point out how long before John Muir and the so-called fathers of the environmental movement that this was happening.
Yeah,
you know, everything old is new again.
Yeah, as with so many other things, you can trace back the environmental movement to the birth of the nation and to the founding fathers.
And Washington, the great general, he's talking about literally taking the tools of warfare and beating them into hoes and plowshares.
He suggests that soldiers should grow regimental gardens, because that would be good for them. It's almost like therapeutic gardening. He's suggesting that already during the War of Independence.
One thing I didn't realize, and this is should be a real call to arms for the native plant movement, is these first estates, these first gardens. I mean, you get the sense that they would have torched a British plant if they found it on the grounds anywhere. It was purely native plants, which, as you explained in our previous discussion about your book on Bartram, the American plants were much more glorious than the monochromatic plants that England knew.
The interesting thing is actually to see that John Bartram is growing native species from all 13 states here, but his customers are all English. So his American customers, they actually want to buy English plants. And then the founding fathers come, the revolution happens, and what they do is they invest native species with patriotism. So it becomes a political statement. So they're using their gardens as a canvas, really, for a political statement. And they want to have as many native species from all the different 13 states to kind of assemble them in their gardens. The 13 states really have to mature from being a war alliance to becoming a truly united nation. So the Constitution welds them together legally, economically, and politically, but it's America's nature that provides this transcendent feeling of nationhood. And it's the kind of untamed forests, it's the rugged mountains that are a perfect articulation, really, of a strong nation. And that's what they all do in their gardens. They all have vistas out into the wilderness, kind of bringing the wilderness into their garden, kind of celebrating the American forest.
Well, I mean, we could keep you here literally forever. It's just it's a great follow-up to the Bartram book, and we can recommend it to any of our listeners. The author is Andrea Wolf. The name of the book is Founding Gardeners. The publisher is Knopf. Andrea, thanks very much for being back on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1 888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
And where is Rob doing great?
I'm from the Philadelphia Manayunk region.
Oh, okay, which every bicycling enthusiast knows about because there is that wall of doom that bike riders have to try to get up during one of those great races they run through the area.
We sure do. We're right around the corner from that wall.
All right, what can we do for Rob in the great area of Manayunk?
Well, Mike, I've got a little garden in my little city backyard here. I'm doing my best with it, and I have these three rose bushes. Now, the two that I'm having a problem with are white roses. They're called Eden Climbers, and they're about 5 feet tall, I would say, from the ground. Now, they have big white roses that bud on them, and they have to be at least the size of my fist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this year, as soon as they started to open up, they were brown, or at least they looked dirty, actually. And, as you look at them, they look almost rotten and gross instead of beautiful and white and open. So I was wondering if you could help me out, see what's wrong with my roses.
Well, the lucky thing about this is there's still plenty of time to get replacement blooms. Now, do you prune your roses?
I have been cutting the buds off after they've been flowering. Of course, I have hundreds and hundreds of them, so mm-hmm. Yes, I cut some off to, put in the living room. Aside from that, I've been just trying to keep the thing out of control and under control and out of my neighbor's yard.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you cut them back in the fall, in the winter, in the spring? Do you, or do you have no reason to do that?
This past fall, I cut the bush back. Man, almost, let's say 30% of the bush I cut back.
You're lucky it didn't die.
Really?
Yes. You should only prune roses either in the dead of winter or in the spring after they've begun to actively grow again. You did take a lot of starch out of their shirts last fall. Now, yeah. Is there any mulch under the roses?
There's a little bit of grass clippings, or I guess it's hay at this point, that I just spread around the bottoms of them. They're a little bit away from my vegetable garden.
Just to
cover the ground.
Did you spread these grass clippings when the grass was still green?
No, it was hay by that point.
Okay, and where did you get the grass clippings?
From the surrounding yard.
Okay, and you don't treat your lawn with any kind of herbicides?
I don't use any kind of chemical pesticides.
Okay. As long as you wait until the grass clippings have turned brown, they are actually an excellent mulch. And you have no discoloration on the leaves of your roses or anything like that.
No, the leaves look great, and the buds look great, and then they open, and then they're brown.
Typically, what you're describing is a very notorious... Well, I shouldn't... I'm going to guess rose sawflies. We talked about these on the show a couple of weeks ago. I've been talking to extension agents throughout Pennsylvania. These pests appear to be on a real tear. And I now realize that some of the roses I have lost over the years that I've attributed to caterpillar damage, or what I called leaf rollers, are actually these rose sawflies, which can look, if you see them, a lot of people don't see them, they can look like slugs or they can look like caterpillars, but they're actually the larval form of a very primitive wasp. The way to protect yourself against these creatures is to inspect your roses every day. When they're budding, you want to look for little punctures and stuff like this. And if you see it, get rid of that rose right away. Now, have you fed your roses anything?
I have not.
I would give them a good feeding of compost, or I would get a natural organic fertilizer. I like fish and seaweed mixes, especially for roses. They seem to thrive on it.
We have a great compost pile. I just pile it around the base of the plant.
Was the compost mostly shredded fall leaves?
No, it's uncooked vegetables from the kitchen, eggshells, coffee grounds.
But it doesn't turn into compost.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
It's very brown and looks like richer earth.
Oh, man. Yeah, but it's not supposed to happen without a lot of dry browns in the mix. You know,
okay.
Kitchen garbage tends to stay kitchen garbage. So I have to say that I'd be worried about that compost. Although if it looks right, smells right, feels right, as long as you're not deceiving yourself. But in the future, you should really be mixing shredded leaves in there. But I want you to feed the roses. I want you to clip off any damaged areas. You know, any buds that are browning up. And then if you really want to be ready, you could preemptively spray the developing rosebuds with either neem or one of the spinosads. Those are two organic pesticides that would stop the sawflies before they could do any damage.
Fantastic. Is there anything I can use or make myself to spray on that?
No.
All right. Neem it is then.
Okay.
Mike, I appreciate your help, and thanks for having me on the show today.
All right. Thank you, Rob. You take care, man. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that wise watering is crucial to helping your plants survive the traditional hot and dry days to come. That means watering infrequently, but for long periods of time. No short spritzes every day. And always try and time your watering to end just as the sun strikes your plants. Don't water in the evening and leave them wet overnight. But don't you go saying, "I told you so," to your spouse just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow and control the bitter herb horseradish. Bitter Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38. Temperature steady at 79 in Center City.
Mike McGrath right back at you with local events. In conjunction with their hosting of the 55th Annual International Convention, the Liberty Bell Gesneriad Society, folks who especially love African violets and other members of that hard-to-pronounce plant family, invite the public to attend their plant sale and flower show free of charge on Friday, July 8th and Saturday, July 9th at the Lowe's Hotel in Center City, Philly. Also on Saturday, July 9th, there's a Kitchen Potager Festival at Linden Hill Gardens in Ottsville. I'll travel up near Erie to appear at the famed Goodell Gardens in Homestead on July 23rd and 24th, and then I'll be at the Hamilton Township Public Library in New Jersey at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, July 26th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
On today's Fresh Air Weekend, neuroscientist David J. Linden talks about why certain things, fatty foods, exercise, generosity, vodka, why these things can make us feel good. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews State of Wonder, new novel by Ann Patchett, and we'll chat with illustrator Christoph Niemann. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 o'clock today here on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week on horseradish. What's the best way to grow and harvest this traditional spice? How do you grow it and get the timing right to have it ready from your garden for the Passover Seder? And what do you do when horseradish gets out of control, which it can? We'll answer all those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Corrine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Corrine. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine today, thank you. And where is Corrine good?
I'm good in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for you?
What I did was it's just as a test for this summer. I bought a patio tomato plant.
Right.
I brought it home. It looked great. I brought it home. It was small. I put it in a maybe a gallon bucket, and didn't have any holes in the bottom or anything. And I proceeded for about 8 days to overwater it. I went to check and I thought it was just sitting in water. So I pulled it out, gave it all new soil, a brand new bucket. It was a 3.5 gallon bucket. I put that in there, made sure there were holes at the bottom, set it up. So about 5-6 days later, I noticed that it started to turn yellow from the base of the soil up the plant. The leaves were turning yellow.
But Corrine, I everyone who's listening right now is really curious. Had it made you angry when you tried to drown it? What was...
Actually, I was just watering it with the intention every day to transplant it into a bigger thing and get it set up. But it took longer than I expected, and when I actually went to check it, it was just sitting in water.
Let's drop back. You say it's in a 3.5 gallon bucket. Is it truly a bucket?
Yeah, I went to the dollar store and bought a bucket.
and poked some holes in it.
Oh yeah, nice ones at the bottom. Yeah. I mean, it's draining perfectly now. That's what I want. It's actually draining good.
3.5 gallons is really not big enough for a tomato plant, even one that is meant to stay compact. So you probably should get it a bigger, nicer container. What did you fill the bucket with?
Potting soil.
Okay, good. And it was just a light, loose, soil-free mix?
Yeah, it was really nice.
Now, did you mix the potting soil with anything else? Did you mix any compost in? Have you fed the plant?
Yes, I used I used Miracle-Gro.
Well, these chemical fertilizers are really not good for plants, and they're especially not good for plants.
Well, actually, I've only done it once. I did it once when I first got it, and a little bit. I only put like maybe a quarter of a teaspoon in the mix. It just, you can hardly tell that it's in there, very lightly.
All right.
And then I did it again when I transplanted it into the bigger.
Oh, so the Miracle-Gro was actually in the tub of death. The first time. I would prefer that you find a real container. The buckets, I mean, let's face it, they are completely unattractive. So try to find yourself something that looks nice, because this plant is obviously depressed.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you have enough potting soil. I want you to try to find a bag of premium compost or bum some compost from a gardening friend. At the very least, switch to a natural fertilizer.
Okay.
And don't over-fertilize it. And then I want you to take off all those lower leaves, all those yellowed leaves. They can't photosynthesize anymore. And by taking them off, you're going to improve the airflow. Matter of fact, do you have the tomato planted deeply in the container?
No. I have it where it is, the soil line comes up about quarter of an inch on the stalk.
Oh, great, great. Well, I'm going to help you out quite a bit here. When you get your new container, I want you to take all those lower leaves off, all those yellowed leaves, and then only tomatoes you should do this with, because they can grow auxiliary roots along the buried stem.
Right.
I want you to put that thing down half, until you're at green leaves. I want where all the dead leaves were to be under the soil line.
You
can only do this with tomatoes, no other plants. Uh-huh. If you can find some eggshells, if you can put together some eggshells between...
I did that already. I actually put eggshells in this mix
Good.
When I did it.
I think if we move this into a bigger container, freshen up the soil, switch to a natural fertilizer, and I want you to use a big enough container that you don't have to water it every day. Or else it's going to stay drowned. You know, you need to really water slowly, saturate the soil, and then let the plants dry out for a couple of days, and then water them again.
Okay.
But I think that the tomato will be much happier that way, and I think you'll essentially be starting with a new plant. Now, if the leaves continue to yellow, it's because it's mostly dead, and you just want to grab another plant while you can still get one in the store. But there's every reason to believe this one could recover, but those yellow leaves are holding it back right now.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, and cross your fingers. I'm going to work it. I'm going to try to save this plant.
All right. Good luck.
Thank, Thank you very much.
Take care, Corrine.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, hi, Mike. I listen to your show on Sunday afternoons. It comes out of Ocean City, Maryland, and I live about 7 miles west of Lewis, Delaware, just west of the bay.
Very good, very good. The ferry that I used to mistakenly say went from Cape May to Lewes, and I know now that it is Lewis, Delaware, where the ferry lands.
I have a small patch of, I bought 3 tomato plants. This was in about the middle of March, and so I nursed them along inside and repotted them, and put them out about the end of near the end of April, and they're coming along nicely. But my problem is I only have about 4 inches of topsoil, and then I have this red sand and clay hard pan.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of, it was so tough for me to, all I could do was dig about a shovel full deep. I almost thought I needed to buy a post hole auger machine.
Right, but you planted your tomatoes anyway.
Right. I've only had to water them. I watered yesterday the third time. I built a small berm around each plant that I could water about maybe 2 or 3 gallons. And then let it soak in.
John, that's these berms, these magic circles don't work. What you want to do is, did you amend the soil with anything? Did you put any compost in there at all?
No, not compost, but I did put lime down, ground.
Why?
Lime.
Why?
Because most of my ground grows a beautiful moss. The only time I amended was last year when the grass got real lush and green. I mowed some and bagged it and put it around on the garden. But
okay, don't do that again, John.
Okay,
don't do that again. You're.
I'm wondering what to use in the hard pan.
Okay, listen. You got to stop swinging wild. All right.
Yeah.
You're kind of making this up as you go along, and you're not like giving your plants a healthy atmosphere. What I would recommend you do is you take this area where you've got your 3 tomato plants, and I'd like you next year, I'll tell you what to do this year as well, but okay, next year I want you to frame out a 4x8 foot raised bed.
A raised bed.
And you're going to fill that bed with half compost, yard waste compost from decomposed fall leaves, and
right,
and half screened topsoil.
Uh-huh.
And then you'll have that good soil on top of your lousy soil. And next year I want you to plant your tomatoes deeply, dig a deep hole, pull off the bottom leaves, bury half the tomato plant below ground. I want you to start saving up eggshells starting around New Year's, and put the crushed shells, dried crushed shells of a dozen eggs in each planting hole. That'll provide the calcium that'll prevent blossom end rot. And you will cage your tomatoes for support, and you'll have great results with that. It's very difficult to grow good fruit in flat ground to begin with. But
right,
when you've got problem soil like yours, It's unfair to the plants. The Red Cross is going to come by with lawyers for your poor tomatoes. And this year, I just want you to find a good source of yard waste compost and mulch an entire inch deep all over the surface of any bare soil around your plants. Get rid of any mounds, and then just water the plants deeply. Just take a hose out to the plants, put it in the middle of the plantings, and just set it to drip at like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And let it run till like 9 o'clock once or twice a week, and really saturate the soil. That's how you're going to get your best results.
All right, I can do that.
All right, good luck, John.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care, sir.
Right, bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. How to handle horseradish? Tony in Fairfax, Virginia starts us off by asking, Mike, I have 3 horseradish plants growing in raised beds. Each is in their second year. Can I leave them in the ground longer and still have them be edible? Should I replant a portion of the root next spring, assuming I should harvest them this fall? Can it be powdered, like you advise with garlic, that is dried and ground up in a dedicated coffee grinder? Basically, how does one go about tending horseradish? Well, horseradish is a pretty tough root, Tony. The only thing this mustard family member requires to become a big, long-lived perennial is deep, fertile soil. So your raised beds are the perfect home for this pungent spice. But 3 plants is a lot. And horseradish has a deserved reputation for getting out of control. So unless you're thinking about going into the horseradish business, I'd cull it to 1 bed this fall. Now, some people treat it as a perennial, and some people grow it as an annual. The perennial people wait until frost has killed the above-ground growth, wait through a couple more frosts, because this improves the flavor, dig up the entire root, they save the biggest sections for kitchen use, and they immediately replant a few of the smallest sections, because big pieces left in the ground can get woody after a year or two. As can horseradish that gets dehydrated. So make sure to water during dry times to get the best eating quality at harvest. Now, the folks who grow it as an annual harvest everything in the fall. Again, after a few frosts have intensified the flavor. They use what they need, and then they store a few small pieces in the fridge or in damp sand in the basement for replanting in the spring. In your region, just outside of Washington, D.C., you could also leave the root in the ground over winter, heavily mulched, of course, and dig up portions as needed. It's the easiest way to keep it fresh, and the flavor should continue to improve as the ground gets colder. Then watch for the very first sprouts to appear above ground in the spring, and immediately harvest all but what you intend to replant. Once that new growth takes off, the root will get watery and lose a lot of its flavor until cold weather returns. Now, processing is not for the timid. Heat is said to quickly dissipate the flavor, so I personally wouldn't try to dry and grind it. You're welcome to give a small batch a try, but I would not attempt such a thing inside the house, unless you happen to have an infestation of bedbugs, termites, or some other unwelcome guests you'd like driven away. Horseradish tea has a long reputation as an effective outdoor pest control. The typical way to process horseradish is by grating. Wash the roots you intend to use, peel them, and then grate them by hand or use a food processor. Warning, warning! This very pungent mustard root gives off fumes that are killer. You can only do this outdoors, and I strongly recommend having a strong fan blowing the fumes away from your face. Hand grating indoors is not recommended. I'd even open a food processor that held grated roots outside with that fan growing strong behind me. Now, use some of that grated root immediately. It's never going to taste better. If you have leftovers, bottle them up with some vinegar and keep the bottle in the coldest part of your fridge. Any unpeeled root itself will also store well in a cold fridge, allowing you to make up what you need pretty much any time over winter. We move on to Sonia in Bethlehem, PA, who writes, My horseradish comes back every year, but the roots are only pencil size. Is there a method to get the big fat roots we see in the grocery store? I'd like to use it for my Passover Seder. Well, horseradish requires deep, loose, fertile soil to make big roots, Sonia. That means double digging or tilling down to a depth of around 18 inches before planting and adding lots of organic matter like compost to the hole, but not a lot of nitrogen. Typically, plants with lots of above-ground growth and tiny roots were fed horse or poultry manure or some other high-nitrogen fertilizer. For Passover, which is a springtime event, I'd plant roots in a plot of loose, rich soil the spring before. Keep it well watered over the summer. Let the top growth die back naturally. Mark the position. Mulch it well. Let it sit down there all winter. And then harvest just before Passover the following spring. Or a little earlier if it starts to regrow fast. Once you get the timing down, you should be a reliable perennial provider of the traditional bitter herb of the Seder table. And finally, Grace, who didn't give her location but echoes many emails we've received over the years, writes, "How do you get rid of horseradish? Over the years, it has crept into every part of our yard. Despite using weed killers like Roundup, it always returns." Well, first, Grace, stop killing frogs and toads and altering your own hormones. Those dangerous spray-on chemicals are never the answer to unwanted plants. And let this be a warning to all. Handle it diligently and horseradish will become a dependable perennial. Ignore it for years, or God forbid, till the soil it's growing in, and it will become as evil as running bamboo. Instead of spraying, you need to dig. As soon as those distinctive sprouts appear in the spring, get the entire root out of the ground underneath. If it's been unchecked for years, take a few seasons to eradicate it by removing it from sections of your yard at a time. Well, that sure was a hot look at horseradish now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to dig a deep hole for me if I don't get out of this studio. Ha! No need for that, Alexis. I already specialize in digging deep holes for myself. Anyway, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse team towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject of your email in the subject line. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters are Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our highly capable intern is Jessica Mandick. Special thanks to our talented volunteer Heather McLean. And endless accolades always to the remarkably patient Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is Al Banks. I'm Horsey Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. An unseen danger of urban growing is the risk of lead contamination in your dirt. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do when Superman can't see through your soil. Plus a heap and helping of your fabulous phone calls.
Ever the raconteur, Mike offers resources on raspberries, roses, rabbits, even rain to help you